Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. The dark plume rose high above the horizon to the north. It had been there for days now, an ominous sign lurking at the edge of the people's sight as they looked outward from the shore of Crete onto the Aegean Sea. It hung there in the sky, grabbing the fishermen's attention as they took their small boats out to net sea bass or collect lobster. It distracted the shepherds, drawing their eyes away from wayward sheep on the rocky slopes of hills and mountains. The scribes, incising lines and curves into clay tablets with their styluses, stopped to stare. Potters left their wheels, kilns, and decorative paints in their workshops, stepping out onto the streets to gaze at the sight. The days since the plume appeared had been unsettling. Ash fell from the sky, leaving thin layers of ultra-fine particles covering the cobbled streets and white stone buildings. The ground shook, time after time. A few unsteady walls had collapsed at various places around the city of Knossos. Houses had burned, set alight by flames knocked loose from braziers, lamps, and cook fires by the earthquakes. Fine pottery, red and white designs emblazoned on black fields, fell and shattered into dozens of shards. In one horrible instant, the sky to the north grew darker still. Lightning flashed in the distance, brief eruptions of light against a pitch-black backdrop. The blackness moved outward from the plume, darker and darker, further and further, lit only by the jagged bolts. They were unnatural, flying around at all angles in the darkness, a random and unsteady source of light illuminating the black. Gasps and moans rose up from the watching people. More and more of them came outside to look. Some were silent, awestruck by the apocalyptic sight. Others sobbed, beseeching the gods for help or mercy in the face of the unimaginable. 5 minutes passed, and then the wall of sound hit them like a hammer blow. A few dropped to the ground, physically felled by the force of the volcanic eruption on the island of Thera to the north, while others bled from the ears. All of them felt the tremendous ringing that came in the aftermath. It was the loudest sound they, or anyone else alive on the planet, had ever heard. A fisherman, out in the deeper water beyond the coast, felt his boat bob well up and down on a large wave that nearly capsized him. Strange to feel a wave like that this far out from the shore, he thought, but it was quickly over. A crowd made its way down to the coast, hoping for a closer look at the plume and the encroaching darkness. The sharpest-eyed among them saw the ripple on the surface of the sea in the distance. The ripple soon resolved into a wave that grew taller and taller and taller as it approached Crete. Taller than any building any person present had ever seen, the size of a hill. A few people simply froze in the face of the approaching doom, while others ran for higher ground. The wave hit the shoreline with concussive force. The tsunami smashed cliffs, inundated coves, and washed away beaches. It crumpled beached ships, big sea-going vessels with masts and oars, into kindling. Whole seaside villages were swept away in a pile of debris. Hundreds of people were killed in an instant. Their bodies washed up for days or weeks afterward. The eruption of Thera, what's now the island of Santorini, around 1600 BC, was just one of the challenges that struck the Aegean Sea in the Bronze Age. But the people who lived in this part of the world were sophisticated and resilient, savvy traders and brilliant craftspeople, builders of palaces and cities. It would take more than one of the largest volcanic eruptions in human history to keep them down. They thrived for centuries afterward. The Minoans of Crete and their neighbors, the Mycenaeans of Greece, left a long and impactful legacy behind them, one that led directly to the heights of the Greek world of classical antiquity. Also, I have some really cool news. I wrote a book. It's called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. If you enjoyed our seasons of Tides on the early modern period, then you'll like this, I promise. The Verge is out now, and you can order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook, which I read, naturally, from your distributor of choice. If you've ever been looking for a way to support Tides of History, ordering The Verge is the best way that you could do it, and I'd really appreciate it. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The Late Bronze Age was a remarkable time in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Near East. An interconnected world sprang up, tying together the lands from Greece and Crete in the west, all the way to Mesopotamia in the east and the Nile Cataracts in the south. Slimmer tendrils reached out across the Iranian plateau and deep into the central and western Mediterranean. Trade pulled this world together. Precious luxury goods, everything from gold and textiles to slaves and pottery to olive oil and weapons, all of them traveled long distances. The currents of high politics cover this vast expanse too. The great powers of the region, like the Hittites, Egyptians, Assyrians, and Mycenaeans, exchanged letters, gifts, and marriage partners as part of their constant, alternating dance of alliance and war. The Hittites of Anatolia fought both the Egyptians and the Mycenaeans, part of a web of conflict and connection that stretched over the entire Eastern Mediterranean and Near East. It wasn't just politics and trade, either. The technology of writing, literary and religious concepts, and of course people all moved from place to place. And because of the prevalence of writing everywhere from Mesopotamia to Egypt to Anatolia to Greece, we can know so much more about this world than we could through archaeology alone. It has characters, flavor, texture, details, the kind of stuff we can only dream about for earlier periods and other places. But as much as this was one big world, it was also a series of smaller ones. Anatolia was a patchwork of different linguistic and ethnic groups, split among a number of smaller and larger states and kingdoms from Wilusa, the Ilion of Homer's Troy, to the Hittite capital of Hattusha. The Near East had Assyrians, Mitanni, Babylonians, Elamites, and Kassites, along with the Egyptians. And last but not least, there was the Aegean, dominated first by the Minoans of Crete and then later by the Mycenaeans of Greece, the direct ancestors of the Greeks who left so many different key legacies to the later world. Today, we'll focus on the Aegean and the later Bronze Age. Not quite up to the Trojan War, whatever that might have been in reality rather than in Homer's poems, and not to the Bronze Age collapse, which we'll get to later in a whole series of episodes. For now, we're going to try to understand the Golden Age of the palaces on Minoan Crete and in mainland Greece. For that, we need to figure out precisely who the Mycenaeans were. If they were, in fact, the ancestors of the later Greeks, we should probably know where they came from, how their society came into being in this distant past. The peaks of the late Bronze Age Aegean were the result of a creative fusion between the cultures and practices developed on Minoan Crete and those of the Mycenaeans on the mainland, so we'll have to understand both of them, as well as what eventually brought them together into a coherent whole. So when we left off last time, the first true palaces had just been built at several places on the island of Crete, to the south of the Greek mainland in the Aegean. At Malia, Phaistos, and Knossos, the emerging elites of what's called the Middle Minoan period, around 1900 BC, had constructed, or more precisely ordered the construction, of massive, sprawling palatial complexes. These were really, really big. The one at Phaistos was about 9,000 square meters, just shy of 97,000 square feet, and was three stories tall. The palace at Knossos was even bigger, 14,000 square meters, more than 150,000 square feet. These palaces were built, quite literally, on earlier foundations and older concepts. The open courts where the resident elites held public ceremonies and displayed their power and status already existed. They seem to have been incorporated wholesale into the new palaces. Yet the construction of the palaces also represented something new in Crete's already long history. They were signs of the emergence of states, of entities ruled by a powerful individual or group that were capable of extracting labor and resources from those lower down on the social scale. At the most basic level, that's what a state is. It's a series of ideas, institutions, and mechanisms for taking people's time and resources and putting it to the uses that the rulers have decided on. Whether the rulers built palaces to show how powerful they'd become, or whether the process of building the palaces taught them how to marshal labor and resources is hard to say. But what's clear is that states and monumental building projects designed to glorify the people who control society tend to go hand in hand. As a note for what follows, I'm drawing on L. Vance Watrous's book, Minoan Crete, An Introduction, along with John McEnroe's Architecture of Minoan Crete, and the relevant chapters of the Oxford Handbook of the Bronze Age Aegean. So the emergence of the palaces marks the beginning of what's traditionally been seen as the Golden Age of Minoan Crete, the later stages of what are called the Middle Minoan and the early stages of the Late Minoan periods. Now, despite being an island in the middle of the Aegean, Crete had always been part of wider networks encompassing the Greek mainland, the nearby islands of the Cyclades, and the coast of Anatolia. At their peak, these networks reached deep into the eastern Mediterranean, as far as the coast of the Levant and even Egypt. Long-distance trade made some people on Crete quite wealthy and provided them with the prestigious symbols that made them a recognizable elite in both life and in death. Now, around 2200 BC, the first stage of long-distance connection, the first international age, as it's called, had come to an end. The Akkadian Empire fell in Mesopotamia. The Old Kingdom ended in Egypt. A major episode of aridification affected the climate. After a couple of centuries, though, things picked back up. Egypt entered the Middle Kingdom, the climate improved a bit, and long-distance trade again began to become a big deal. It's likely that people were on the move in the Aegean around this time, too. New types of funerary practices appeared on Crete, ways of burying the dead that had been common in the Cyclades and on the Anatolian coast. Whether this means new migrants made their way to Crete, or simply that there was enough contact for the practices to spread, it means that the networks of trade and communication were growing denser once more. On the flip side, however, settlements on Crete were much more likely to be fortified in the time immediately before the construction of the palaces. When we put all of this together, we can get a vague sense for the context in which the first palaces were built. More danger and perhaps more threat of violence, but also more trade, more ideas coming in from elsewhere, more opportunities for elites to enrich themselves, more incentive to show off their power and their status both to their lessers and the other elites residing on Crete. That's one of the really fascinating things about the palaces on Crete, from my perspective. It's not like a single powerful person or dynasty showed up on the island, took over, and then built a big house for themselves. Nor were they built on unoccupied territory, with people flocking to them after the fact. Instead, the first palaces were built in or right next to settlements that already existed. And they were already big settlements, too. Knossos had somewhere between 6,000 and 11,000 inhabitants, Phaistos had 7,500 to 10,000, and Malia had at least 5,000. The elites already existed. The palaces were the product of competition between the different groups of powerful people that were in the process of emerging from, again, these already existing home communities on Crete. Three of them were built almost simultaneously on different parts of Crete. Each of them was slightly different, each grew out of a slightly different local context, and each surely belonged to its own powerful group. By the time the palaces were in full use, after about 1900 BC, Knossos may have had as many as 17,000 inhabitants. So what made these people powerful and rich? Crete had fertile farmland and the bounty of the sea lying just offshore. That was enough to create and feed large urban communities like the ones I mentioned. The countryside was full of villages, hamlets, and lone farmsteads. Even the mountains were full of sheepfolds and shepherds' compounds. Yet, while it was densely settled, the island wasn't overflowing with copper, tin, gold, obsidian, or the other natural resources that generally made a place and its elite wealthy during this period. It wasn't just a matter of digging into a seam of natural riches and profiting. Instead, their wealth came from trade. Trade seems straightforward, but we shouldn't take it for granted. It requires a whole bunch of different things. Standards of value that the parties involved can agree on, the ability to communicate, the means to transport goods from place to place, and above all, trade requires information. Information about what people want, what they're willing to pay for it, what kinds of risks the transaction and the journey will entail, and so on. Viewed from this perspective, even small-scale exchange is something of a miracle, much less the range and extent of trade that we start to see in Crete and beyond during this period. What's remarkable about it to me is the fact that it existed on multiple scales. It encompassed a whole bunch of different ranges and goods, not just one thing for another. On a local scale, Minoan ships plied the coastline. They were loaded down with relatively utilitarian pottery, the kind of stuff that was suitable for day-to-day use. A ship dated to this time sank off the north coast of Crete, and was full of amphoras, jugs, and jars, just really basic stuff. That's the kind of stuff that in earlier ages would have been produced in a home community and used there, rather than produced elsewhere and traded. A bit further afield, Minoan ships took higher quality pottery to the islands of the Aegean, like Melos, Naxos, and Rhodes, and the western coast of Anatolia. They picked up metals, especially copper, lead, silver, gold, and finished bronze, and brought them back home. Beyond that, these Minoan traders went even further. They reached the ports of Syria, the Levant, and Egypt, dealing mostly in luxury goods. This kind of trade drove Minoan society to become wealthier and more sophisticated. It also provided a spur to craft specialization, a sign of what we call social complexity. In the Eastern Mediterranean, there was a great deal of demand for specialized luxury goods. Minoan craftspeople produced to fill that demand. They made exceptional, highly decorated pottery vessels, especially a kind called Kamares ware. They made exceptional metal items like vases and inlaid weapons. They made leather shoes. And they especially made high-quality textile clothing from the wool of the sheep that grazed in the mountains of Crete. We know this because written documents from the elite societies of the Near East list goods from a place they called Kaptara. That was their word for Crete. These goods were highly sought after, enough that the king of the city of Mari in Syria sent Minoan finished products to the powerful Hammurabi of Babylon as a gift. We can also assume that the Minoans exported wine, olive oil, and wood, bulkier goods that would have taken up more space on the ships amid the smaller cargoes of luxury goods. In return, they picked up cargoes of precious stone, tin, copper, finished metal products, and even hippopotamus ivory. But this increasing exchange transformed Minoan Crete in other ways, too. A recently discovered burial cave in eastern Crete was full of Egyptian objects and locally made imitations of Egyptian objects. Minoan seals of this period show the images of the Egyptian gods Taweret and Bes. They show griffins and other motifs common in the Near East. There's even a vase with an image of a sphinx. It went even deeper than this, though. It's safe to assume that the Minoans who built the first palaces at Knossos, Malia, and Phaistos got the idea from their trading missions to the east. There, in the cities of the Near East and Egypt, palaces were a common sight. They were royal or noble residences, sure, but they were also so much more than that, like the temples of Mesopotamia we talked about a couple of months back. Palaces were storehouses for foodstuffs and valuable goods. They were centers of production that were full of workshops of various kinds. They were administrative hubs, coordinating the collection and distribution of food and raw materials. And they were mercantile centers where long-distance trade was planned and carried out. All of this was in addition to their basic function of serving as a place for the display of power and status. The palaces of Minoan Crete picked up these functions, along with the basic monumental appearance that palaces had in Egypt and the Near East. But they also differed in really key ways. Their open courts were open to the city streets. They weren't like the walled-off palaces of the Near East that separated the elite from the commoners. Even now, there's no scholarly consensus as to exactly who ruled from the palaces of Minoan Crete, or what the basis of their authority actually was. Crete shows no signs of divine or semi-divine royal imagery, like we see elsewhere in the Near East. Even military functions seem to be a later addition. We can assume they probably had a religious and ceremonial role of some kind, which they carried out on behalf of their wider community, but that's vague speculation. We don't really know how they interacted with the broader mass of the public, though it's probably a safe bet that they took counsel from a more restricted elite group at the top of society. What we can say is that they built the palaces and administered from them, and they used writing to do it. Minoan Crete, like the sophisticated cultures of Anatolia, the Near East, and Egypt, and unlike the Bronze Age world of Europe, was a literate society. They left behind two distinctly different forms of writing, one of them called hieroglyphic and the other a script known as Linear A, both of which were developed independently on Crete rather than having been developed from Near Eastern or Egyptian examples. Cretan hieroglyphics and Linear A might be different ways of writing the same language, or they might represent multiple different languages. Most assume that Linear A was used to write a language that we call Minoan, but despite the better part of a century of effort, we don't even know what language family Minoan belonged to, much less what the texts actually said. We can read numbers, and that's about it. Despite that, we can firmly say that these were administrative documents. They were connected to the production, storage, and trade of goods. Even though the scripts developed on Crete, it's a safe bet that the idea of them, like the idea of the palaces, presumably came from further east. Palaces, urban life, and long-distance trade would define Crete for centuries to come after 1900 BC. But it was a bumpy ride. After about two centuries, around 1700 BC, the first palaces at Knossos and Phaistos were violently destroyed. Other sites, like Malia and Gornia, also suffered major destruction at this point. This might have been due to an earthquake, a common occurrence in the Aegean, but we shouldn't rule out warfare or social unrest either. Even so, this way of life was durable enough for the palaces at Knossos and Phaistos to be immediately rebuilt. Still greater heights soon followed.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Between 1700 and 1500 BC or so, the Minoan world reached its greatest heights. Knossos, the largest of several cities on the island, may have had as many as 40,000 inhabitants. That would have made it one of the largest cities in the world. The palace at the heart of Knossos was a truly magnificent place, over a hectare, 10,000 square meters, or almost 110,000 square feet in size. Visitors could enter the palace from the south, walking along a massive elevated causeway. From the west, visitors followed another raised walkway through an open, tree-lined court on their way to the monumental facade, a two-story construction with open windows floating on the second floor overlooking the court outside. The palace's west-facing porch was painted with frescoes of a running bull, a motif that recurred time and again in the palace's decoration. One of the corridors leading from there to the central court featured an overhead veranda painted with a charging bull. The frescoes decorating the walls around the stone throne at the core of the palace complex depicted hawk-headed lions, griffins, palm trees, papyri. Storage rooms just off the main palace spaces held huge amounts of grain, olive oil, wine, treasure, and imported luxuries from distant lands. Workshops created incredibly fine decorated pottery, beautiful textiles, and all kinds of metalwork. Some of these products would travel thousands of miles away from Knossos to their final destinations, trade goods to be exchanged for the wonders of the faraway world. The palace was a place of power and sophistication, the apex of a society at its highest point. It was an exceptionally sophisticated complex in an architectural sense, too. It was built in various phases, but it spoke a coherent language of design. It's laid out horizontally, but rather than presenting a single unified appearance, it's studded with projecting sections and then shadowed recesses. Its roofline rises and falls. Some sections are higher than others. There's no single viewpoint from which to take in the whole thing. There's no single place to stop and be awed. Instead, visitors were kept in motion. Because of its intentional asymmetry and the way that people flowed through it, the palace's size was impossible to judge. It seemed to go on forever, and that was probably the way it was intended to be understood. It's easy to focus on these palaces and look outward from them onto the rest of Minoan society. It's a natural inclination, both because of their size and the fact that they've been so thoroughly excavated, especially at Knossos. If you go to Crete, that's what you're going to see. But there was far more to life in Minoan Crete than what was happening in the palaces. As the art historian John C. McEnroe puts it, tourists to Knossos today almost certainly see far more of the palace than even the city's residents probably would have. The palaces may have been the heart of Minoan society, home to their rulers, but they were really just the most striking pieces, their visible tips of a much more compelling iceberg hidden beneath the surface. Each palace was part of a broader urban landscape. The palace at Knossos, the largest one in the largest settlement, took up no more than 1 or 2% of the total space of the city. Rather than being defined by the palace, it was simply one outstanding part of the urban fabric of Knossos. Large mansions sat adjacent to the palace, probably the homes of high nobility or royal associates. Beyond them were houses of varying sizes. Some of them were big buildings that probably housed wealthy merchants. Others belonged to artisans or other middling workers. Slaves occupied service quarters within larger households. And beyond the cities were a ton of smaller settlements. One well-excavated example, a place called Gornia, had probably just shy of 1,000 inhabitants. It had its own small palace at the center, an open marketplace, cobbled streets, and a bunch of other houses. There were a bunch of settlements like Gornia scattered throughout Crete. Below them were smaller towns, with a villa at the center instead of a palace. Beyond them were clustered villages, hamlets with a few houses, lone farmsteads, and up in the mountains especially, shepherds' compounds. The humble farmhouses and shepherds' compounds were no less a part of Minoan Crete than the palaces. They produced the food that fed the kings and nobles and priests who lived amid the frescoes and monumental facades. Their labor cared for the sheep whose wool was woven into fine garments for export, and so on. And what about the homes of the sailors who crewed the ships, the vessels that took those trade goods to their final destinations and made the Minoans wealthy? Shouldn't we care about them? Minoan Crete was far from an egalitarian society. It had a strong social hierarchy with its palace-dwelling elites at the top and mountain shepherds, poor farmers, and slaves at the bottom. Yet, it seems like Minoan Crete was far less dominated by its elite than, say, Egypt at the same time. Literacy was fairly widespread in comparison to societies further east. Ceilings, carved images used to make an impression in wax or clay that marked a person's identity or ownership, were in use even by artisans and merchants, not just a priestly or administrative status group. The varying sizes of houses speak to something like a middle class of craftspeople and sailors. Even in gendered terms, Minoan society seems to have been more open than the extremely patriarchal cultures of the Eurasian steppe and Mesopotamia. The dominant deities in Minoan religion seem to have been female, so far as we can tell, and women figure prominently in artistic depictions of processions and ceremonies. Compared to some of the other spots we've seen, Crete in the late Minoan period wasn't a bad time and place to be alive. The diet was quite varied, with wheat, barley, legumes, figs, nuts, grapes, olive oil, cheese, eggs, milk, and wine. There was quite a bit of meat in the diet and a great deal of seafood, ranging from sea bass to lobster to octopus for those who lived near the coast. Now, scholars today no longer think Minoan society was peaceful. There's too much evidence for fortifications and walls, for defensive structures, occasional destruction. That's leaving aside the abundant occurrences of weapons and grave deposits and in art. It was normal for Minoan men to be armed, and societies full of armed people are usually that way for a reason. But the late Minoan doesn't seem to have anything like the endemic high-level violence of, say, the Sintashta culture on the steppe, or the fractious days of constant war between city-states in Mesopotamia. Aside from the basic living conditions, this was a world with broad horizons and possibilities. We can guess that, relatively speaking, a great many Minoans traveled beyond their homes. We know they moved a lot locally, shepherds coming down from the mountains with their flocks, farmers going from rural farmsteads and hamlets, taking their produce to the villas in a local village or town, merchants moving loads of pottery from one small port on Crete to the next. The coastal towns and cities were full of sailors who crewed the ships that traveled to the Cyclades, mainland Greece, Anatolia, and the eastern Mediterranean beyond. You didn't have to be a member of Crete's uppermost elite to have seen distant cities, heard foreign languages, or picked up some treasured item in a faraway land as a reminder of your travels. This made late Minoan Crete perhaps the most cosmopolitan and deeply connected place we've yet encountered on our journey through the distant human past. Yet this didn't and couldn't last forever. Around 1600 BC, the precise date is uncertain for a bunch of heavily debated and highly technical reasons, a massive volcanic eruption on the nearby island of Thera, now called Santorini, wrought havoc throughout the Aegean. This was one of the very largest volcanic eruptions of the past 10,000 years. Only the Mount Tambora eruption of 1815, which caused the year without a summer, was certainly larger. And Thera is only about 70 miles, or 110 kilometers, north of Crete. The eruption buried the Minoan settlement on the island of Thera, a place called Akrotiri, in a deep layer of ash. Because of the prevailing winds, the ashfall itself probably didn't leave much of a mark on Crete, but it absolutely buried the coast of Anatolia to the northeast. What caused the greatest damage in Crete was probably the tsunami that accompanied the eruption. It was at least 10 meters or 33 feet high, and it may have been much, much higher than that. For a society that relied so heavily on ships and the sea for trade and resources, it's easy to see how devastating this could have been. To make matters worse, earthquakes and presumably more tsunamis accompanied the eruption. There was probably a volcanic winter, resulting in disrupted crop harvests and reduced yields. The islands of the Cyclades, far nearer to Thera itself, would have suffered even more than Crete. These were the closest trading partners of the Minoans and a source of many of the valuable raw materials on which they relied, especially metals. The coast of Anatolia, too, another bunch of close trading partners, would have been enormously affected by all of this. And that's leaving aside the existential uncertainty created by such an apocalyptic event, the social unrest that surely would have gone along with such terrible things, second-order effects from the loss of trading partners, and so much more aside from that. Even so, the Minoans bounced back from this catastrophe. This speaks to the tremendous resilience of the society they'd built. Their long-distance trading connections didn't disappear. Raw materials continued to be imported, like copper and tin ingots and elephant tusks. On the other side of things, fine Minoan pottery showed up on Cyprus, in the Levant, and in Egypt. Egyptian tomb paintings from this time depict Minoan delegations arriving in Egypt. There are hints of Minoan influence in Egyptian art more broadly. At last, however, this golden age finally came to an end. Around 1450 BC, buildings all over Crete were destroyed. Palaces, villas, houses, farmsteads, whole towns and city quarters, all of them set ablaze at roughly the same time. We don't know why this happened or what caused it. Possible explanations range from natural disasters, especially one or more earthquakes or another volcanic eruption, to internal unrest, to foreign invasion. After this calamity, whatever it was, only one palace on Crete remained functional. Whatever dynasty ruled at Knossos seems to have spread its influence and control over the entire island. Only a little while later, however, even this dynasty came to an end. A new elite arrived on Crete around 1400 BC. They took over the palace at Knossos, and they set about ruling over the remnants of Minoan society. These new rulers spoke and wrote a different language, one that would have a very long and distinguished future. They were outsiders, the Mycenaeans.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
The Mycenaeans get their name from the city of Mycenae, in the northeastern part of the Peloponnese, the peninsula that makes up the southern part of the Greek mainland. It was at Mycenae, a little bit north of Argos and about 75 miles or 120 kilometers southwest of Athens, where archaeologists first found traces of a flourishing late Bronze Age society in Greece. Palaces, cities, fortifications, beautiful art and architecture. the Mycenaeans were sophisticated and cosmopolitan, a constituent part of the fascinating world of the Late Bronze Age that stretched from the Aegean to Mesopotamia and Egypt. To make matters even more compelling, however, the Mycenaeans were the direct ancestors, linguistic, cultural, and presumably genetic, of the ancient Greeks. The society that would shape so much of the Mediterranean and global future had its foundations deep in the world of the Late Bronze Age. These were the people who came to Crete, took over the palace at Knossos, and proceeded to rule over the Minoans around 1400 BC. They had already been living in mainland Greece for some time, and they were in the process of filling their domains with cities, palaces, fortresses, and small competitive states. But the roots of the Mycenaeans were to be found in the distant past and far away, on the vast grasslands of the Eurasian steppes in the mists of the earlier Bronze Age. That's because Greek, like so many other tongues, is a member of the Indo-European language family. The speakers of the language ancestral to Greek were presumably cattle and sheep herders, horseback-riding migrants who brought their speech, way of life, and not a few of their cultural traditions to the shores of the Aegean with them. Even more than the other branches of Indo-European we've discussed over the past months, the precise origins of the Greek language and its speakers are difficult to identify. We can't be certain precisely when or how they arrived on the Greek mainland. We can't be sure where they came from, or to which other groups or branches they were related. We have a few vague clues derived from linguistics, genetics, and archaeology, but they're just that, vague clues. So be aware that this is even more speculative than these discussions usually are. Among the Indo-European languages, Greek stands on its own. It has no siblings or even distant cousins, at least none that survived long enough to enter the written record. Instead, Greek is the sole representative of its branch, like Albanian and Armenian today. Without that kind of linguistic kinship, it's hard for us to reconstruct the path that brought the ancient proto-language to its eventual homeland in Greece. But there are a couple of hints that help us. Greek shares a few developments with the earliest attested examples of Indo-Iranian and with Armenian, and a couple with the Phrygian language of Anatolia, which we only know through a limited number of scattered texts. The language is one not very helpful piece of the puzzle. The other is genetics, but we have only a few samples to work with, and they don't give us a ton of precision. What seems clear is that there were people with steppe ancestry living in Greece no later than the Middle Helladic period, roughly 2000 BC to 1700 BC. They might have come from just north, in the Balkans, or maybe Hungary or the Danube corridor. But it's also possible that they came directly from the steppe, perhaps as representatives of the catacomb culture that succeeded the Yamnaya just north of the Black Sea. If that's the case, maybe they went overland, but maybe they went by water, crossing from the Crimea or the grasslands north of the Caucasus by boat. Those scattered linguistic hints, the correspondences with Indo-Iranian and Armenian, may support the idea that the pre-Greeks came directly from the steppe, where they would have been in contact with those other groups at a very early stage of development. For now, though, we simply don't know. The ancestors of the Mycenaeans arrived in what's now Greece during a time of turmoil. The Middle Helladic period, as it's known, marks something of a low point between the heights of the earlier and later parts of the Bronze Age. At the end of the early Helladic, mainland Greece underwent a severe contraction. The population dropped. Small rural sites were abandoned. Large monumental buildings were destroyed by fire. The settlement hierarchy, meaning that there were larger and smaller settlements tied together in a discernible ranking of importance, totally disappeared. So did most of the trade that had connected Greece to Crete, the Cyclades, and the eastern Mediterranean. Life in the Middle Helladic was hard. One cemetery sample from Lerna reveals that fully half the population died before reaching the age of five. Another Middle Helladic cemetery, at Koufavouno in Laconia, has a number of male burials with serious injuries, including a body that had been completely cut in two. This seems to have been the environment in which the ancestral Mycenaeans, probably speakers of the Proto-Greek language, arrived in their new home. They might have come as invaders, causing the destruction and dissolution we see so clearly in the archaeological record. Alternatively, they might have arrived in its aftermath, settling into unoccupied territory that had been vacated by its previous owners. They're both possible in some measure, with an initial wave of raiders followed by settlers, or migrants who then made war on their new neighbors. However they came, we can be sure that the ancestors of the Mycenaeans did not eliminate the existing inhabitants of Greece. We know this thanks to ancient DNA. Samples taken from later Mycenaean burials showed discernible ancestry from the steppe, but far less than their Middle Helotic ancestors a few centuries before. They really only have a trace of steppe ancestry. For the most part, the Mycenaeans of the Late Bronze Age were descended from the Neolithic and Early Bronze Age inhabitants of Greece, descendants of the Neolithic farmers of the Aegean. This means that they derived most of their ancestry not from relatively recent migrants from the steppe, but from the people who had already lived there for centuries, millennia beforehand. This is fascinating and revealing because it tells us that rather than a total population replacement, which we have seen elsewhere in this series, we're talking about a small group of newcomers carving out a place for themselves. That place happened to be at the very top of society. We can guess that their influence grew so pervasive that it was their language that eventually came to dominate and replace that of the earlier inhabitants of Greece. Some of their myths, traditions, institutions, and religious beliefs survived their long journey over space and time, and they formed much of the basis for the mythology and fabric of later Greek culture. We don't know exactly when or how this happened. In contrast to Crete in the Middle Minoan period, when the islanders were building their first magnificent palaces at the heart of cities and sending ships to trade in ports hundreds of miles away from home, Middle Helotic Greece was a parochial and isolated place. It took until the end of this period, around 1700 BC, for things to pick back up. That's when we start to see the reemergence of a settlement hierarchy, with some larger sites dominating their smaller neighbors. Fortifications, hints of monumental buildings, an increase in population, and the first emergence of competitive elite groups. These were the seeds that eventually blossomed into the fruits of the Late Helotic. This Late Helotic, a 6th-century period from around 1700 BC to just after 1100 BC, encompassed both the rise and fall of Mycenaean society. The end of the Middle Helotic and the beginning of the Late Helotic, around 1700 BC, roughly the time when the palaces on Minoan Crete started to reach their peak, probably not a coincidence, was a time when big things were shifting on the mainland. The clearest evidence of this emerging new world comes from Mycenae, where a series of incredibly rich burials mark the beginning of a new and different age. These are the shaft graves, where members of a new and striving elite class tried to set themselves apart by taking their wealth with them into death. If you've ever seen an artifact from Mycenaean Greece, you've probably seen something from one of these shaft graves, especially what's called the Mask of Agamemnon, a golden funeral mask with a finely worked three-dimensional face complete with a handlebar mustache, which was named for the famous king of Homer's Iliad. This funerary mask predates any actual historical Agamemnon by at least a few centuries, but the artifact itself is only one of an incredible collection. There were actually two circles of shaft graves at Mycenae. The shaft graves were long, vertical tunnels dug down into the bedrock and then covered with a roof. Circle B was a bit older. When it first came into use, the burials were poor, just little pits or stone-lined kists. But over time, the grave goods got richer and the burials got more elaborate. An electrum, a mixture of silver and gold, death mask was found next to one of the deceased. We see weapons and sets of drinking vessels. The other circle of shaft graves, Circle A, contained even wealthier burials. The Mask of Agamemnon was only one of a number of gold funerary masks. Gold jewelry covered the 8 men, 9 women, and 2 children buried in the 6 separate shaft graves. They were armed with an array of swords, daggers, spears, and knives, and they had a rich selection of gold and silver cups and goblets to drink deep in the afterlife. Their graves were marked on the surface with funeral stelae, carved markers indicating the presence of the dead below, and they were probably covered with a mound as well. An enclosure wall surrounded the whole burial complex. It marked it off as a special place, and its occupants as special people. We can tell a whole lot about the society that produced these graves and the people who were buried in them. It was one with an elite, and that elite valued symbols of violent prowess in the form of hunting and warfare. They liked to show off, which was probably a sign that they were coming out of an unstable period, trying to establish themselves as rulers. And we know that the people who eventually ruled from the palace and fortifications at Mycenae, centuries afterward, remembered these ancient elites buried in the shaft graves of Circle A. Perhaps 3 centuries after the last person was interred in the shaft graves of Circle A, the whole complex was carefully restored. The settlement's fortification wall was being extended, and a massive, monumental new gate was being built, the famous Lion Gate, with its pair of lionesses carved in relief and facing each other above the entrance. These much later rulers of Mycenae respected the elite dead of the distant past. Maybe they saw them as the founders of their ruling dynasty or founders of the city itself. Either way, their memory was preserved and respected, but not the slightly earlier burials of Circle B. There's a fascinating symmetry here. The construction of Mycenae's Lion Gate came towards the very end of the Mycenaean period as a whole, while the shaft graves of Circle A belong to its beginning. Both of them are markers of the power and status of the elites who ruled Mycenaean society. In between those two bookends was a period of extraordinary flourishing. It's not a coincidence that the Mycenaean period begins at the same time as the Minoans reach their peak on Crete. The types of weaponry and artistic motifs we see in the shaft graves of Mycenae point toward the intensification of contacts between Minoan Crete and the less populous and wealthy mainland. In many different ways, the emerging elites of Mycenaean Greece modeled themselves after their island counterparts. They traded with them, importing finished objects and raw materials. The Mycenaeans adopted Minoan styles of art, especially pictorial representation, basically wholesale. These exotic goods from a sophisticated neighbor helped to mark out these new Mycenaean elites from the common herd, much as access to exotic goods from the eastern Mediterranean had helped to create the elites of Minoan Crete centuries before. And as with these Minoan elites, it's a safe bet that trade lay at the heart of the Mycenaean ruling class's initial acquisition of wealth and power, though with a slightly greater emphasis on warfare and fighting. These emerging Mycenaean elites built centers for themselves, places from which they could rule. Large and small, these sites share common characteristics. They're placed high up in a commanding position overlooking good agricultural land. They're often fortified with powerful stone walls. And they practically always sit along a main line of communication and trade leading from the sea to points further inland. In rocky and mountainous Greece, there were many such places. Many local elite groups emerged to take advantage of these spots. They competed in display and probably war. Successful dynasties absorbed their rivals, consolidating their power and eventually building palaces and something like states of their own. Unlike the vast empires that eventually grew up in Mesopotamia or the Kingdom of Egypt, which was united by the Nile, Mycenaean Greece was a patchwork of small kingdoms. Mycenae, Pylos, Athens, Thebes, Sparta, Iolcos in Thessaly, and Orchomenos in central Greece. Each of them had its wanax, its king, probably resident in a palace. They got that idea, like so many others, from the Minoans, even if their palaces looked a bit different. They adapted the Minoan technology of writing as well, taking what we call Linear A and adapting it to write their Mycenaean language. We can read Linear B, as it's called today, and it's one of the earliest examples of a written Indo-European language. Each Mycenaean wanax ruled a genuine state. Small in comparison with other states of this period, but states nonetheless. They had settlement hierarchies and administrative centers in the form of their palaces, the places from which they ruled the surrounding land. As elsewhere, writing was a fundamentally administrative technology, which they used to record all sorts of information on tablets. Writing was fairly widespread, so far as we can tell, probably because it was so useful to the wanax and his administrators. Writing allowed the administrators, servants of the wanax, to record the quantities of food that were brought to the palaces, the amounts of finished goods that were produced in the palaces' workshops for export, how much land had been given out to which recipients, and so on. The wanax could mobilize the labor of his subjects for a variety of purposes, whether that was building a new rock-cut tomb for his dynasty, constructing a road leading from the palace to a port at the coast, or hauling huge masonry blocks for a fortification wall. The ruled might also be expected to serve as soldiers when the wanax went to war in his chariot, sheathed in a suit of bronze plate armor and carrying a wickedly sharp bronze sword. The Mycenaeans were enormously successful. Their states might have been small, but they were densely populated, highly connected to their neighbors and to trade partners near and far, and their rulers controlled them tightly. Evidence of a Mycenaean presence shows up in Anatolia across the Aegean, Epirus in present-day Albania, along the coast of Italy, even as far west as metal-rich Sardinia. Mycenaean kings clashed with the powerful Hittites on equal terms. They traded with the Levant and the Egyptians. It was probably inevitable that these warlike kings from mainland Greece would set their sights on the flourishing island just to the south. We don't know exactly when or how, but at some point around or after 1400 BC, a Mycenaean dynasty planted itself in the magnificent palace at Knossos. The writing tablets archaeologists have discovered in the layers dating to this period were written in Linear B, encoding Greek, rather than Linear A, recording the Minoan language. The invaders must have brought their language with them, at least for administrative purposes. It's probably not a stretch to connect the widespread destruction we see at this time all over Crete, including a great deal of burning, with the arrival of the Mycenaeans. And this dynasty seems to have controlled the whole island, or at least been the only rulers who made use of a palace. Only the palace at Knossos remained in use, full of Linear B tablets and still functioning as an administrative center, while all the rest of the magnificent palaces fell into disrepair or were totally destroyed. So much of the Mycenaean way of life had been adapted from the Minoans, and eventually they returned the favor with fire and conquest. The same fate eventually befell the Mycenaeans. Their palaces were destroyed, their cities were abandoned, and their system of writing was forgotten in the mists of Greece's Dark Age. Yet before their demise, they formed part of the fabric of the flourishing Bronze Age world. Their traditions and ideas, so many of them adopted from their Minoan neighbors, lived on, and eventually shaped the Greek world of the Classical Age. As legacies go, that's not a bad one. Next time on Tides of History, we'll head east once more. It's been a while since we visited the fertile black earth of the Nile Valley, and it's time to return. We'll explore the Old Kingdom, the Age of the Pyramids. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. I've also written a book called The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It's available now on hard copy, ebook, or audiobook that I read, of course, from your distributor of choice. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.